ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीं अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम्। ओ भगवद्गीता with which Partha was enlightened by the Lord Narayana himself and which was incorporated in the Mahabharata by the ancient sage Vyasa, the Blessed Mother, the destroyer of rebirths, of miseries, showering down the nectar of Advaita and consisting of 18 chapters upon thee, O Bhagavad Gita, my loving mother, I meditate. We were dealing with the 59th verse, I think, yesterday.
Yes.
Vishaya vinivartante niraharasya dehinaha resavarjam rasopyasya param drishtva nivartade. It's a very important verse, and from a psychological point of view, it has got a great significance. The implication is, even we try to control our senses and try to focus our senses towards spiritually helpful objects by withdrawing them from harmful objects, we may not always succeed. When we are confronted with, or when we are in the midst of temptations or difficult situations, we may be swept off our feet. This does happen. Even if we do a lot of spiritual sadhana, do a lot of reading, meditation, contemplation, still, sometimes when we are surrounded by certain circumstances and conditions which tempt us, perhaps we become victims, we may be influenced, we may lose our track. This could happen in spiritual life. So somebody was mentioning, in a dark night of the soul, it is an inevitable stage through which every spiritual seeker has to go through. Now here, Lord Krishna, the teacher of Gita, makes an important statement. Till we reach the ultimate spiritual destination, till we get full realization, we won't be able to completely root out the harmful tendencies. We cannot guarantee success in spiritual life. That's the implication. So, the great commentator makes an important statement. Yadyapi vishyopalakshitani vishaya shabdabdhyani indriyani athava vishya eva nirakarasya anakriyamana vishayasya kashte tavasi sthitasya murkasya api vinivartanti dehinaha dehavataha rasavarjam rasu rago visheshu yatam varchayitva. I shall explain this in detail. Now the idea is this. Even when we do a lot of spiritual practices, meditation, japa, taking the holy name, contemplation, reading of holy scriptures, and try our best live in an atmosphere of spiritual tendencies, still, sometimes, when we are surrounded by certain circumstances, we may be tempted away. Why does this happen? From a psychological point of view, Vedanta says, whatever we do physically, whatever we think, and whatever we speak, all these will create an impression in the mind. Whatever conscious action. I can give an example. In the waking state, suppose you are walking the streets of San Francisco. While walking the streets, we may see cars, vehicles, pedestrians walking the streets. We don't take any special notice of them. Or if you're walking here in Lake Tahoe, we may see pebbles and stones and grass and weeds. All these we see. We don't remember them later. Why? Because we don't make a conscious effort to notice them. So they don't leave an impression in our mind. But suppose while walking, you come across somebody, a long lost friend, or a more unpleasant experience. Suppose you are chased by a dog and you have to run. Now you will remember this incident quite a long time. So what happens is, when these events take place, we focus on those events, we identify ourselves with somebody who was chased by a dog, or we identify ourselves with somebody who saw a long lost friend. So we don't forget that event. So that event makes a strong impression in our mind during the waking state. In dream state, maybe the same day when you are dreaming, when you are sleeping in a dark room with eyes closed, you may perhaps see yourself walking in the streets of San Francisco under the burning sun during the daytime. You are seeing all this, not with your physical eyes, but with the mental eye. So the memory comes to the surface. So the impression or tendency that you have registered in the mind in association with that event, corresponding event, suddenly comes to the surface when we are dreaming. So whatever we experience consciously during waking state is relived, re-experienced in dream. So strong impressions gathered during waking state come back to the surface of the mind and we re-experience those things. Memory functions like that. Memory and dreams are more or less the same. When you remember somebody whom you have seen last year, you are not seeing the person in front of you. You are not seeing him with your physical eye, but you are seeing him with your mental eye. Because no action is possible without the combination of eyes and mind. No visual action is possible without the eyes and mind coming together. And you cannot hear anything without ears and mind coming together. Even if you are looking at an object, if your mind is elsewhere, you won't be seeing it. But even when you are not seeing an object, when the object is not in front of you, still you may remember mentally you are seeing that again. So whatever we experience during waking state comes back to the surface in dreams, depending upon the intensity with which this event takes place in our life. So what really happens is, whatever thoughts have gone through our mind will create an impression, a tendency in the mind. So it will remain there hiding in a corner. And maybe several years later, when we find ourselves in a circumstance, in a condition surrounded by circumstances, the tendency to re-experience that will come to the surface. How to root out this tendency? This tendency goes much deeper than impressions, psychological impressions. It remains hidden. As I said yesterday, day before yesterday, of course, also, you know, the two principles in Vedanta, which are in fact two laws, laws of rebirth and laws of karma, association of karma and consequent phenomenon of rebirth. This, they go together. That's why there are certain tendencies that we cannot logically explain in the light of our experiences in this life. No hypnotist will be able to trace your take your mind backward, even to childhood days, because there is no trace. But those tendencies are very strong in our mind, spiritual tendencies, tendency to meditate, to tendency to contemplate on higher spiritual values, which you certainly did not learn in this life, you are not trained, but there is a natural tendency, inherent, built-in tendency. It comes from previous life. So whatever we experience in this life, we remember very vividly with name and form. But whatever we remember in the form of a strong tendency, without name and form associated with those tendencies, come from previous life. That is what Vedanta says. So this verse says, Resavarjam Rasopyasya Param Drishtva Nivartade. When do we succeed in rooting out completely certain tendencies which may be harmful in spiritual life? Only when we reach the highest spiritual experience. When we realize the fact that we are not just these psychophysical mechanisms, we are not just with these physical bodies or senses, we are something behind all this and beyond all this. We are the Supreme Consciousness, the Atman, which is beyond the body, which is beyond the mind, whom tendencies cannot influence. And once we realize we are the Atman, which cannot be affected by any of these experiences in waking state, at that moment, even the innermost tendency, which is hiding within, but it doesn't come to the surface under normal circumstances, that's also rooted out, is completely destroyed. That's the implication. But how do we reach that? We can reach that state by constantly remembering the fact that we are something beyond this body. We are something beyond this mind. Because the negative tendencies and impressions will remain in our mind only so long as we identify ourselves with this mind or body. The moment we understand we are not this body or mind, then whatever is accumulated in mind also will disappear. We are the Atman, the universal, the omnipresent, the all-pervading reality, the immanent reality. When we realize that, it goes away. We may not be able to realize it all of a sudden, but constantly remembering this fact also will be very helpful. So in times of temptations, in time when in times of difficulties, or sometimes when we are facing a crisis, when we are confronting a tragic event which may upset the mind, a lot of work to do, no time to rest, and you don't get the expected result, but we cannot get away from the work. It's a dilemma. At that time, if you can remember, well, I am not this body or mind or anything. I am beyond all this. Even if you theoretically remember this by reading, that is helpful. Because Vedanta says the first fundamental discipline in spiritual evolution is listening carefully. Listening with concentration. Listening in a broader way we can interpret. Reading, what you call swadhyaya, that is sravanam. Sravanam means listening. So if we listen to great noble spiritual ideas with great concentration, with a sense of sanctity, that's very important. With a sense of sanctity and seriousness. If we listen to great spiritual ideas, or if you can't listen, reading. Because by reading, we are coming in contact with great spiritual minds of the past. By reading Gita, we are actually coming in contact with the great mind of Krishna, who taught this message. Krishna is not standing in front of us. But by reading Gita, we are coming into direct communion with Lord Krishna's teachings. In a way, we are taking the message from him. So that's why swadhyaya means careful reading with meaning and concentration. and careful listening with a sense of sanctity and concentration, we can be benefited by this idea. Many of the problems that we normally have to confront in our daily life can be faced with ease if we keep this in mind. We are not just mind or body or something. Because at the most, restlessness can only upset the mind and also the body, of course. What affects the mind also may ultimately affect the body. Psychosomatic principle if you apply. But still, if you remember that I am not this physical body which gets tired, I am not this mind which becomes unhappy or anxious or becomes worried, I am not this intellect which fails to understand subtle spiritual ideas, I am beyond all this. I am the Atman, the universal spirit, the universal consciousness, which is a source of bliss. This, even if we can remember as a theory, that is also very helpful. That is not the ultimate goal, but that's certainly a very good beginning in our spiritual evolution. And that will slowly help us to root out the innermost tendencies we sometimes come in the way of our spiritual progress. But at the highest level, Lord Krishna says, the greatest spiritual person, the one who has reached the highest spiritual goal, can live in the midst of temptations and problems, still remain unaffected by them. So, there is a statement in the work of a great poet, Vikara heto sadi vikriyante yesham na chetamsi sa eva dhiraha. It's a very interesting. Sometimes deva dhiraha, like that. You find this statement. Kalidasa makes a statement in. Kalidasa says, who are the greatest? Dhiraha means a person endowed with supreme spiritual intelligence. Who is that person? The one who lives in the midst of adversities, in the midst of problems, still remain unaffected, still cannot be tempted. That person is dhira, means the spiritually enlightened person, the spiritually intelligent person. But this is the ultimate goal. This is not possible at the beginning. So at the beginning we should not try to practice it. Sometimes many of Vedantic students ask this question. If Atman is everywhere and we are also Atman, then why should we worry so much about studying spiritual practices? Well, if you reach that level at the experience level, there is no need. But right now, for most spiritual seekers, it is only a great ideal to be reached. See, if you become a Christ or a Buddha, you can try to convert other people, transform other people's lives. But before becoming a Christ or Buddha, if you try to convert other people, they will convert you to their side. Very often the effect will be opposite. There's a story of a robber who was transformed and converted into a saint by Lord Buddha. Buddha was one day walking through a deserted road. So a robber was living there. So some of his friends warned him, this is a cruel man living in the middle of the forest. He normally will sometimes rob and kill the wayfarers, so don't go through that deserted road. They warned Buddha, but Buddha did not pay heed to their warning. His name was Angulimala. It's an interesting story in Buddha's life. The name is very significant. He had a very wonderful hobby. He used to kill poor wayfarers and the travelers, rob them and then cut off their fingers, anguli means their finger, and make a garland of them. And then that was his main hobby. Killing people, cutting off their fingers, making a garland, and that was his great ornament. This is such a cruel man he was. So Buddha was told by some of his friends, it's very risky and dangerous to travel through that deserted road. But Buddha was quite confident that he would be able to change his mind. So this robber came, but he found this man was not afraid, Buddha was not afraid. And he tried to catch up with him. Buddha was slowly walking. And though this robber was running as fast as he could not catch up with Buddha. Then Buddha turned, looking at Buddha's face. This man found, he's a strange man. He's not afraid of me as other travelers used to be. Others used to run away, used to catch them, kill them, and cut off their fingers and make a garland of them. But Buddha was different. He was not afraid. With a smile, he confronted the robber. And then he fell at his feet. He became, Buddha gave him some instructions. This robber became a saint in course of time. This is the story. Now, before becoming a Buddha, we should not try to confront robbers. Try to confront. It's very dangerous. So, great spiritual seekers who have reached ultimate goal, who have realized their identity with the all-pervading Supreme Consciousness, Brahman, who have realized, who are living in perpetual communion, who are experiencing this identity of the individual and universal soul, every moment of their life, they can converge. That's the idea behind. So, at that stage, when we reach the ultimate spiritual goal, we can become so perfect that we can live in the marketplace and meditate. We can live surrounded by temptations, still be free from temptations. We can live in the world without being worldly minded. An example is given in Sri Ramakrishna's gospel. You know, when you have to cross a river, you have to use a boat. Water should not enter the boat. The boat will capsize. So, what should be on the surface of the water? Water should not be within the boat. Boat should be on the water. That's the idea behind. So, we can live in this world, but worldliness should not enter the boat of our life. In fact, that solves most of the problems. To be very frank, even an intellectual understanding of this principle will be very helpful in spiritual life, in any life. If we can live in the world without worldliness, worldly temptations entering the boat of our life. That's the idea behind here. Lord Krishna makes in another context, an illustration, gives an illustration, Padma Patra Mivambhasa. These lotus leaves, they grow in water, but water drops do not make them wet. That's the idea behind. So we can live in this world, but that doesn't mean that we should become worldly minded. So that is possible when we reach the ultimate goal. In a way, for a spiritual seeker, even at the beginning of spiritual life, even an intellectual understanding, a constant remembrance, either by reading or by listening or by contemplating on this idea, will be very helpful in confronting many of the problems that we face in life. So, that's the idea behind. Now we are coming to the 60th verse. Yatato hyapi kaunteya purushasya vipaschitaha indriyani pramathini haranti prasabham manaha. Perhaps we may be struggling hard to reach spiritual goal or spiritual destination, maybe striving for liberation. Still sometimes, even a wise person, even an advanced spiritual seeker may be tempted by the senses. It could happen. a highly spiritual, an advanced soul could be tempted by this. I have already given the example of Saint Teresa of Avila and others who combined, who synthesized God's grace and human effort. Well, how this happens in daily life, in spiritual life? There's a classic illustration in the form of a story from one of the devotional classics in Bhagavata Purana. It's a famous one, very, very touching one. There was a great king. He was a mighty emperor. Towards the end of his life, he decided to leave his kingdom and comforts behind, declaring his son as the heir apparent. And he decided to go to forest and spend the rest of his life on contemplation and meditation. Now, I will explain a few points related to this tradition. In ancient times, there was tradition among Vedantins, Vedantic tradition, that when an householder reaches 55 or 60 years of age, or when his hair grows gray, or when he sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, he should leave his home and spend the rest of his time in a hermitage, spending the rest of his lifetime in meditation. With his wife, he should go to a lonely place. In the old tradition, it's called forest. Forest actually means a lonely place. One can be in a cave but still be in the midst of a crowd if mind is restless. And you can live in your own home in a secluded room and meditate. Still, it would be as good as living in a forest. So, grihasthasu yada pasyed vali palidam atmanaha apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasaye. This is an important verse in Manu's constitution, Manusmriti. It belongs to 3rd or 4th century BC. The idea is this. An householder who has married, who has led a responsible life, and who has brought up his children, and also his grandchildren, when grandchildren are born, or when he becomes old, he should not continue staying in the home, interfering in the affairs of children and grandchildren, and becoming a pest and sometimes a nuisance. Very often it happens. So he should go to a lonely place, maybe a temple, maybe a hermitage, and along with his wife. So grandparents, grandmother and grandfather should go to a forest and spend the rest of his life, their lifetime, in meditation and contemplation, thinking of the higher spiritual values. They have no more social responsibilities because they are looked after everything properly. And the lineage is guaranteed when the grandson or grandchild is born, granddaughter is born. Now, similarly, this king left his home, palace, comforts. He declared his oldest son, senior most son, as the next king and went. Now, and he spent the rest of his lifetime in contemplation, meditation. Towards the end of his life, maybe 2-3 years before he passed away, something happened in front of his hermitage. And a female deer was being chased by a lion. And this female deer tried to cross a stream. In the process, it gave birth to a baby deer. And the old deer passed away. The mother deer passed away. Now the king, this emperor, felt pity on the baby deer which was getting drowned. So he jumped into the stream, saved, and this baby deer grew up in the hermitage. Now, after some years, it was time for him to pass away. He knew that death was approaching. So what happened? Remember, he had left his kingdom
his comforts and his people, or for spending the rest of his lifetime on meditating on God or spiritual ideas. At the last moment, what happened was, he was so worried about the fate of the deer growing up in his hermitage that he was not thinking about God. He became so attached to the little animal instead of leaving it to the care of God and himself meditating upon the Lord. He was worried about the fate of the poor deer. And he passed away and he was reborn as a deer. So in Gita, there is a slogan, Yam Yam Vapi Smaran Bhavam Tyajatyande Kalayavaram Tam Tame Vaidika Undeya Sadatmat Bhava Bhavidaha. Meaning is this, when we die, whatever impressions are uppermost in our mind will decide our rebirth. So that's why every person should try to lead a spiritual life, and we should start our spiritual life as far as possible at the very beginning of our career when we are small. It doesn't mean that if we cannot start spiritual life when we are during younger days, we'll be lost. Yesterday I made this point clear, and day before yesterday as well. At any moment you can practice spirituality. That will remain in your account. You will not be lost. Because if we can't reach the ultimate goal, we will be reborn again. And whatever little spiritual practices we have done, we'll be able to draw benefit. We'll be benefited by our spiritual practices, however little it may be performed in this life. But it doesn't mean that we can wait till the end of our life. So the great spiritual classic says, Kaumara Acharet Prajnaha, Bhagavata says, we should start spiritual life when we are very young, as far as possible. Otherwise, the inherent tendencies, negative tendencies, may try to block our path, create a strong obstacle in spiritual life. That's why life is a preparation for leaving this body with a smile on the face. Death should not be considered to be something fearsome, something scary. It becomes a creative crisis as we go from one room to another room. Death should be looked upon not as a terror, not as something terrible, but as a creative crisis that we can face with a smile. To drive home this point, I can again refer to the same classic, and then I will come back to the subjects to drive home this idea. In the Bhagavata Purana, it's a famous spiritual classic. There's a dialogue between a king and a great sage. Parikshit is the name of the king, and sage is Shuka. This king somehow happened to commit a sin. It so happened, I won't go further into this story because that would take a long distraction. Somehow this king happened to commit a terrible sin. He insulted a sage. A sage was sitting in meditation, deep meditation. He took the body of a dead snake and put around his neck. He entered the hermitage. The sage was meditating. The king didn't know. The king mistook him to be an arrogant fellow who won't treat him properly, who won't even offer a glass of water. He was thirsty and hungry. So the king maybe sometimes in a great man can sometimes commit undesirable, maybe heinous sin. So he insulted the sage and went away. The son of that sage came after some time. He found, and then he cursed the king. He didn't know it was the king who had done it. Anyone who has committed such a heinous crime, a sin, will be dead within seven days. He will be bitten by a snake and he will die. That is the curse with the little boy, the son of the sage, put on the king. So this king, his name was Parikshit. He came to know that he had only 7 days to live. 7 into 24 hours. Now, what will we normally do if we know that we don't have a lot of time to live? Some people become terribly upset. Some people may withdraw all the money from the bank and finish it within the specified period. But this king was a wise man. Though he committed such a hideous sin by mistake, he was a great man, by mistake he happened to commit it. So he knew that he had committed a sin, he deserved his fate, he left his kingdom and palace, came to the banks of Ganga, the holy river, and there a number of saints and sages are gathered. One of them was the greatest sage of those days, Shuka, and the king puts a question to this sage. What should a dying man do? The question is as important for a living man because, as I said, you know, life for an intelligent person is a preparation for happy ending. Because if a person can live this world with a smile on the face, with the memory of God within the heart, he is a really intelligent person. So this king puts a question. Atha prichami samsiddhim yoginam paramam gurum purushasyeha yatkaryam mriyamanasya sarvada. Like that number of questions. I won't go into those details. Now look here, great sage. I want to ask you a question. What should a person do if death is staring on him in the face? The answer is given in the next chapter. The sage answers. By any means, by performing selfless action to help others, or by praying to God, or by spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical analysis as to who am I, like Ramana Maharshi, you know, am I this body, am I this mind, am I this intellect, who am I? I am the real, all-pervading reality, Atman, which is beyond this body, mind, intellect, and so on. So, Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, any of these means. Whatever may be, if you can't practice spirituality, do something good for others without any selfish motive. That is also one way to leave this world with perfect happiness within. Or pray to the Lord, spend your time in meditation. Or think of who you are. And this inquiry, if done with a pure mind, will take you to the highest spiritual realization. By whatever means possible, try to leave this world with a smile, with remembrance of the Lord within the heart. So, the answer was taken very seriously. Edavan Sankhyogabhyam Sudharma Parinishthaya Janma Labha Parapumsam Ante Narayana Smriti. The essence of this verse is this. By performing selfless action for the good of others without any selfish motive, through meditation, through prayer, whatever may be, you should leave this world remembering the Lord within. Or, without being afraid, you should be able to face the reality of death as a creative crisis, not as something terrible. Now, coming back to the earlier story, as I said earlier, you know, Bharata made one mistake. He left his kingdom, his palace, everything, in order to be able to lead a meditative life so that he could leave this world remembering God. But instead of that, he remembered only a deer. So what happened? He was born as a deer. But again, we have to remember that deer did not forget its past. In his past life, that deer was a great devotee, the great emperor, King Bharata, who gave up his kingdom in order to attain spiritual liberation. So that memory was strong in his mind. That's why those who come and listen to these spiritual talks should have performed some spiritual practices sometime in this life or in the previous life. Otherwise, you won't be able to withstand this. Because Vedanta is not a very pleasant thing to hear for those who are not interested. It's something terrible. You people cannot face it for one moment. It'd be terribly boring. So even those who are able to intellectually withstand the onslaught of Vedanta should have done a lot of spiritual practices, if not in this life, in the previous life. So the deer remembered its past life. So it did not move out, it did not join, it did not mingle with other animals in the forest. He remained and lived in a hermitage and passed away, thinking of God. Remember the emperor, the king who left the kingdom, passed away remembering the deer, but the deer passed away remembering God. And the next life, the deer became an enlightened person. It was born as a, what you call, jnani, as a sthitapragna. That's our topic here. It was born as a sthitapragna, as a spiritually illumined, liberated person. So, and then, of course, I need not go further into the story. And he, when he reached his death, he could face the reality of death with a smile, as if going here back to San Francisco. The great, it's called Jadabharada, he became Jadabharada in his third incarnation. He could leave this world with a smile on his face and remembering Brahman, Atman, God in his heart. So, at that stage, when you reach that stage, nothing can tempt you. But before you reach that stage, we must try to remember our spiritual goal, either by meditation, or at least by reading, or by listening to talks and lectures related to that subject, or by engaging in a conversation on such subjects, because that will help us to keep our mind on in the realm of the higher level of spiritual ideas. This is the idea behind it. Now in the 61st verse, there is a story, there is an important verse. Tani sarvani samyamya yukta asita matpareha vasyehi yasendriyani tasya prajna padishthita. No one should try to control and restrain and discipline all these senses and then try to remain calm and collected, meditating on the Supreme Lord, the all-pervading reality as the supreme goal to be attained. Such a spiritually enlightened person is steadfast and his senses are perfectly under control. Because senses can be a source of trouble, senses also can be a source of help and consolation and guidance. Senses, when controlled, become our friends, guides, and philosophers. When not under control, senses become tormentors and tyrants. As I said earlier, license of freedom given to the senses means spiritual slavery. But freedom from the tyranny of senses means spiritual freedom. If we can keep ourselves free from the tyranny of senses, it leads to spiritual freedom and liberation. But if freedom is given to the senses, it leads to spiritual slavery. So in the Kathopanishad, there is an imagery which illustrates this point. The whole life is taken as a journey in a chariot. And who is the one traveling this chariot? Our individual soul. We are all traveling the chariot. What is a chariot? Our physical body is a chariot. Now, who is the charioteer? The one who drives the chariot? Our intelligence, buddhi. And what are the horses? Senses are the horses. So body is the chariot, the vehicle. Intellect is the one who is the driver of the chariot. We are traveling in the vehicle, sitting in the vehicle, the chariot, and our senses are the horses. Sense objects constitute the road through which the chariot is being led by the horses. Now, whether we reach our goal or not, whether we will safely reach our destination or the horses will take us to a precipice, depends upon the ability with which we control the horses. So if the mind or intellect is capable of controlling the senses, the horses, then the horses will take us to our proper destination. Otherwise, the horses may take us in the opposite direction. So Atmanam Rithinam Vidhi Sariram Rithamevacha Buddhintu Saradhim Vidhi Manapragrahamevacha. Mind is the reins with which intellect controls the senses. The intellect is the driver of the charioteer. Mind is the reins, horses are the senses, and the road are the sense objects through which the horses take us. So if the horses are distracted by some objects on the road, trying to eat some dry grass or something, maybe near a precipice, then we will not reach our destination. So the point is, we must be able to control the senses. So mind should be trained to control the senses. If mind is controlled by the senses, death, spiritual death is the destination that we are going to reach. Spiritual death is the result. If mind is not able to control the senses, rather if senses are able to control the mind, we won't reach the destination. We may reach in a hospital, the ICU. On the other hand, if we can train our mind using our intellect properly, we can control the senses, the horses. We can reach the destination. Now, how do we succeed in controlling the senses? As I said, you know, mind is the reins, but the reins is in the hands of intellect. Intellect should train itself and become competent to control the senses, the horses, using the reins properly, the mind. For that, we must keep our intellect and mind filled with spiritually useful, helpful ideas. That's the idea behind. We have got intelligence and mind. We have got the five senses of perception. The five senses of perception, as I said yesterday and day before yesterday, they go out of their own respective objects. And this connection between senses and sense objects carry to the mind tendencies which may be good, which may be very bad. Bad tendencies will poison the mind, and that will break the reins, and also will render the intellect incapable of controlling the horses, the senses, with the mind. That's why, whatever may be the means at our disposal, our five senses of perception and mind and intellect should be diverted, channelized, oriented towards spiritually helpful ideas, impressions, tendencies, and so on, so that our mind will be full of, mind will become spiritually healthy and competent enough to control the horses. It's a very interesting idea which is established here. That way Shankaracharya says, Tani sarvani samyamya samyamanam vasigaranam krutva yuktaha samahitaha san asida matparaha aham vasudeva sarva pratyagatma paro yasya samatparo na anyaha aham tasmat iti asida ityarthaka. So the great commentator always tries to connect this idea with the principle of Advaita Vedanta, Advaita philosophy. What is the principle? See, Aham Vasudeva. You may have heard this name Vasudeva. It's a typical name in Sanskrit. But its real meaning is, what is the real meaning? The real meaning is this. I am the inner real self. I am the inner reality. I am the immanent reality. I am the inner reality. Antaryami is called the real Atman residing in all beings, which is also all pervading. In fact, that's the real meaning of the word Vasudeva. That's the idea behind it. Sarva Pratyagatma means the inner self residing in all beings, the Atman residing in all beings, the immanent supreme reality, which is also the omnipresent or pervading reality, the transcendent reality, Atman or supreme consciousness. This idea, if you can keep in mind, as often as possible, all the time if possible, that will save us from the temptations of the sense objects. And that will render our intellect and mind competent and capable of controlling the senses so that we reach our spiritual destination. The horses should be properly controlled by the intellect using the mind properly, so that the horses will not take us over a precipice. They will take us to our destination. This is the idea. In the next two verses, which are very famous, Lord Krishna gives a graphic description of the evils of uncontrolled mind. If mind is properly controlled by the intellect, which is enriched by creative, spiritually useful ideas, then mind becomes healthy and it controls the senses properly. On the other hand, if the mind is not properly controlled, what happens? This journey, we won't be able to reach the end of the journey. Instead of reaching our destination, the horses, the senses, will take us over a precipice. And we may fall into gorge at the end of the journey. That's the idea behind here. Next two verses. So Shankaracharya, they commented that uses some strong language here. Atha idanim parabhavishyataha sarvanarthamulam idam ucchyate. He says, what happens if the mind and senses are not properly controlled? It becomes the cause of complete destruction and disaster in our life. That's the idea behind. So the key to leading a proper spiritual life is to properly lead the senses in the proper direction, the horses. If you remember that imagery of the traveler in a chariot. We are all traveling in a chariot. The chariot itself is the body. The charioteer, the one who drives the chariot, is intellect. Horses are the senses. For controlling the horses, the driver will need reins, its mind. The road by which the chariot is moving is the world of senses. The whole world is a world of senses. It becomes a source of trouble for the unrestrained mind. But it is not a problem for a sincere spiritual seeker who is able to control the mind properly. And for controlling the mind, the most fundamental discipline is listening to great spiritual ideas, becoming familiar with, becoming acquainted with the great spiritual ideas. If you can't listen reading, if you can't read, discuss, still if that is not possible, try to live in the world of those spiritual ideas. There is an interesting chapter in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Of course, today there is no time to go through. It takes some time. But still, it may be very important to remember. Before entering the next verse, I shall give a brief description. It is called that chapter in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the most important and perhaps the biggest Upanishad. The most important Vedanta scripture belongs to Vedic tradition, the largest Upanishad. Now, there is one chapter in which the supreme reality, the all-pervading reality, the immanent reality is conceived, looked upon as the light of all lights, Jyotisham Jyoti. That particular section of the Upanishad is called Jyotir Brahman. There, it is in the form of a very interesting dialogue. It's highly metaphysical. And it's a very important chapter for us to read and contemplate on. It's a dialogue between a great king who was also an enlightened person, Janaka, and the greatest philosopher of that time, Yajnavalkya. So the dialogue is this. The king asked this question to the great sage, the philosopher. During daytime, how are we able to move about properly? What is the source of light which enables us to live in this world, to move in this world, to do our work, and so on? Kim Jyotirayam Purushayiti has a meaning here. Hey Yajnavalkya, Kim Jyotirayam Purushayiti means, hey Yajnavalkya, what is the light which enables a person to live in this world, to do his work, and to move about properly? So, aste karma gurude pallede vipalyeti, like that. Janaka asked the question. Now, if anybody asks you what enables you to move about during daytime, the natural answer will be sunlight. So, jyoti is light. So, Yajnavalkya answers, sunlight is what enables you. Very simple. And the question is apparently very simple, but mind you, it will take us to the highest and deepest metaphysical discussion in the Vedantic tradition. Simple question, simple answer. And another question, next question. Suppose the sun has set in the west in the evening after sunset, Astamidhi, Surya Chandra, see. Now, if sun has already vanished in the west in the evening, what enables you, Kim Jyotirayam Purushayiti, what enables a person to do, to sit, to do his work, to move about, etc.? The natural answer is Chandra Jyoti, moonlight. Very natural, in the evening. Suppose there is no sunlight and no moonlight, what enables you to see things? Fire. You start a fire. Agni Jyoti. Now the question arises. Suppose there is no fire. You are sitting in a room. There is no sunlight. It is midnight, dark, no moonlight. No fire. You cannot, don't have a matchstick with you. Then what do you do? How do you know about some obstacles moving in a distance? A vehicle is passing the street. How do you become aware of the movement of a car in the street at a distance? Vak Jyoti, Shabda Jyoti, sound. Now, can sound become light? Here we should understand, light doesn't mean physical light. Light means something is revealed, because the fundamental function of light is to reveal something. This light reveals the existence of this book. So, the primary function of light is to reveal things. So, a light reveals itself and the light reveals other objects. When light is there, the book is revealed. The book cannot reveal other objects. The book needs the light from another source. So light should be understood in his philosophical dimension, light means reveal. And for revelation, you don't require physical light, because sound or walk, sound becomes the light for a person who is sitting in a dark room in pitch darkness, who has no access to fire, moonlight or sunlight. Because with his ears he can hear the sound of a moving car in the at the distance. When his mind and ears come together, when they focus on something, it is able to be aware, to become aware of the movement of a car at a distance. So sound becomes light. Now go another, go further. Suppose there is no sunlight, no moonlight, no fire, and you can't hear something. You are deaf. Then also in your mind you think of many things. You have seen many objects during daytime, and you are sitting in a dark room without seeing anything. You will be seeing yourself walking in the San Francisco streets. And where is the light then? You can see yourself moving, doing business, meeting people, discussing philosophy. All that you can remember in your mind. When even though you have no access to sunlight, moonlight, or sound, or fire, it is Atma Jyoti. Because so long as the Atman, the Supreme Reality, the immanent reality which is residing in all beings, is present there, it makes you aware of things. It enables you to relive, to re-experience whatever you have experienced from in previous life. So Atma Jyoti is the light of all lights. Jyoti San Jyoti. If Atma Jyoti, if the light of Atman is not present, all other lights are absolutely meaningless and useless. Because all other lights borrow the light, the ability to reveal things from Atman. If Atman withdraws itself from our body, from our senses, then your body may be all right. Many people die without any serious health problem. Their eyes are all right. That's why we are able to donate eyes. It could be used by another person in whom Atman is present. So, that is a reality. When Atman is present, our senses, our body, mind, intellect, all of them are endowed with the power to function, the power to reveal. When Atman withdraws itself from the body and the senses, mind and intellect, then they become completely non-functional. So Yajnavalkya says, Atman is the light of all lights. All other lights, they borrow light from Atman. So, as far as we are conscious of the fact that Atman is the supreme reality, if at least intellectually and theoretically, through sravanam means proper listening, or mananam means proper contemplation, through meditation, if we can remind ourselves that we are the supreme Atman, which is the light of all lights, the source of all knowledge, existence, knowledge and bliss, then we can keep ourselves away from the path of temptations. That's the implication. Now we will have a short interaction for 25 minutes. You can
Swa. Swami, with the light of the Atman be consciousness?
Yes. In fact, these are different terms used. In this particular Vedantic text, Atman is conceived as the supreme revealer, analysis of the supreme reality as the light of all lights. The word used is Jyoti. So you should always remember, Jyoti doesn't mean physical light. Jyoti means that which reveals everything, or that in whose presence everything becomes revealed. That's the idea.
Now the senses that you're talking about, sight, sound, and the perception of light, and the absence of light, you have sound. These are all varying levels of vibration. The scientists would say sound moves at this wavelength, light moves at this wavelength.
Yes.
There's a wavelength beyond that that we don't perceive with our senses. We know that it exists, though, because we know, for example, that dogs can hear at higher frequency than humans can hear. So we know that it exists, even though we can't perceive it directly.
Yes.
Ourselves. The consciousness and awareness of it comes from within.
Yes.
As you say, and it's all pervasive, not necessarily beyond what we can perceive, but beyond it, and includes it at the same time. Inclusive of everything we perceive and beyond what we perceive in the same moment. So we can fit this into a rationalistic scientific explanation if we wish.
Yes. You refer to the dog, or no, there are many animals whose senses function much more vigorously, whose senses are much more powerful.
Sense of
than,
smell, for example.
Yes, than human beings. Their senses are instruments. See, when electricity manifests in the form of this instrument, it becomes light.
Mm-hmm.
In the heater, the same electricity manifests as heat. In a refrigerator, the opposite, it becomes cool. So, it depends upon the medium, the instrument through which it manifests. So these dogs and certain animals have got much more powerful media or instruments through which the same power manifests. But in certain other faculties, ability to think, to rationalize, those animals don't have those instruments. So our body, our mind, intellect, these are all instruments, media through which this Atman manifests, like mirrors. In a very beautiful, clean mirror, the sunlight reflects much very, very clearly, in a very effulgent manner. But in a dirty, cloudy mirror, there is only just little light. Even a big mirror, in a big way. So, all living beings have got instruments, these instruments of varying power and frequency and vibration and ability to manifest. Depending upon this variety, the manifestation takes place. But there is one fundamental difference between human beings and the members of the animal kingdom. Human beings alone can consciously work for their evolution. The animals cannot. Because animals' instinct are more or less instinct. Their intelligence is more or less instinctive. They have to be trained. Then they will pick up the skills and the higher faculties. So, I can just quote to establish it, try to make this clear, the point more clear. I can quote one statement from Swami Vivekananda. It's a very radical statement. He says, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. You have to go deeper in the statement. An amoeba is symbolic of the most primitive level of evolution. Buddha, in Sanskrit, Buddha means the enlightened. in an enlightened, spiritually enlightened person, the same Atman manifests on a much higher degree. So we can't say that in amoeba there is no manifestation at all, but the manifestation is a lower degree. So not difference in degrees, not in kind. And in Buddha, the same Atman manifests on a higher degree. In an evil man, the manifestation is there, but the instruments are faulty. And slowly these instruments must be cleaned, just as a mirror has to be cleaned up, so that it reflects the effulgence of sunlight properly. So, the way it manifests, the degree of manifestation, the kind of manifestation, depends upon the variety, the distinct characteristics of the reflecting medium.
Now, we could say, can we assume that human beings would like expanded range in two particular categories? First of all, expanded range of expression. Secondly, expanded range of perception. Would you care to comment on those?
Well, expression and perception. Even among human beings, there are different levels and degrees.
The desire to increase that
is
a natural
tendency. Even the sheer volume, the ability to express and pursue,
mm-hmm.
varies from human being to human being.
Yes, but the desire to increase
that
range
is
inherent in all
yes,
human beings.
Yes. Even in these desires, this variety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, so you find in the same family, five brothers, five children, who go to the same school, who are brought up in identical family surroundings and conditions, and etc. So genetically, there is not much difference. But sometimes they manifest contradictory characteristics. How do we explain this?
You explain it
by previous lives and
tendencies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So when we try to think of differences in perception and expression, the difference in characteristics and tendencies acquired in previous life also applies.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise we may not be able to fully explain this variety, these differences.
Did you say that the natural desire for improvement
is inherent in everyone. But in which direction?
Mm-hmm.
Direction,
perception and expression.
They're even perceiving and expressing what? See, a businessman, people who are born with a strong desire for enjoying wealth.
Mm-hmm.
They make good bankers, good businessmen. In the same family, his brother may be interested in throwing all these away, go to a forest and meditate, go to Vedanta Society, he's doing selfless service day and night, getting no salary, and deriving a great bliss and joy by listening to these things. They don't earn $1, they may lose it.
These are different
avenues of expression. So in both illustrations you can find a tendency to improve, but
mm-hmm.
in two different directions.
Yes, the avenues.
So this difference is sometimes to be explained in terms of accumulated
tendencies
and characteristics. That's why this life is only the tip of the iceberg. It is only the tip of the iceberg. In Vedantic tradition, it is said, you know, if you reach a very high level of spiritual growth, you will be able to look inward and study our own characteristics. This is one important discipline in Patanjali Yoga also. Not in Hatha Yoga, please.
No.
In Yoga, Raja Yoga philosophy.
Raja Yoga, yeah.
The ability to look inward, to analyze our own mind through Samyama. And that helps us to explain some of our own inherent tendencies. At a higher level of spiritual growth.
Would you say that Hatha Yoga might be a stepping stone to Raja
Yoga? Yoga can be certainly very helpful.
Stepping stone to Raja Yoga.
Yes. Not as a not invariably, but it can be a great help if done properly and with a proper understanding. Otherwise, it can just become a physical exercise like gymnastics and other things. But it certainly helps us because, see, breathing, proper breathing, breath training under a proper teacher can help you to restrain the explosive, the tendency to give explosive expression to your anger. Suddenly, you can, they say, you can lengthen the gap between the emergence of the thought and its expression.
Mm-hmm.
See, when a thought flashes in the mind, normal man gives expression to it simultaneously. Those who practice breath control or meditation can remain for a few split seconds quiet between the emergence of a thought and its outer expression. I think it's clear.
Yes.
Let me see. Is it all right? This thought is coming to me. Is it all right? The ability for self-analysis, which is in a way, which is the one fundamental line of demarcation between the animal kingdom and human beings, the ability for self-analysis, which of course it takes you all the way to spiritual emancipation. But the ability to stand away from the instinctive flow of evolution and ask the question, where I'm heading, what's the meaning of life? Not necessarily metaphysical questions, purely from ordinary standpoint. Where am I? Is it all right? What I'm doing, is it all right?
Mm-hmm.
At the highest level, it takes you to the highest metaphysical question. What's the meaning of existence? What's the origin of the universe? What's the mystery of life? Even before going to those metaphysical levels, at the ordinary level, we can ask the question, what's the purpose of my action? Is it all right? The ability for this self-analysis and to lengthen the gap between the emergence of a thought and its natural expression is possible by practicing certain disciplines, if done properly, scientifically, and after being established in the fundamental disciplines, it's called yama and niyama. It's very important. Otherwise, it is good. It's certainly good. It is good for keeping BP, diabetes, tension level under control. But it may not take you the highest spiritual goal, but still it serves a good purpose. But there are many practitioners of Hatha Yoga who gradually graduate to the higher yoga, evolve to higher level. There are many.
It's said that if we can, the longer we can keep our bodies healthy, then the opportunity for reflection and enlightenment
exactly,
is increased.
Exactly.
Length of time.
It's a very practical explanation. But we should guard against being obsessed with the physical. And we should always remember the physical is the means to go beyond the physical. That's the idea. So that's why there have been many great teachers of Hatha Yoga who popularized Hatha Yoga, who also insisted on this point. We should practice higher spiritual values, which Patanjali himself explains, you know, yama, niyama, ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, parigraha. The yama, niyama, shauja, sandosha, tapaswa, adhyaya, isharapunidhana. Sorry. I think we already did. Anybody else? Any other question?
Yeah,
please.
You spoke about awakening state and dreaming state.
Dreaming state.
What about deep sleep? In the deep sleep state,
Sushupti, deep sleep, the third one.
Yeah. And tendencies are still there?
Yeah.
Or are we totally disconnected of
this? Excuse me, the last part of the question.
About the deep sleep state.
Yes.
Are we still connected with our
tendencies and impressions? Yes, in deep sleep state, these tendencies and impressions remain in a dormant condition. They are sleeping, they are deep asleep. Because we are not aware of it. It's a state of complete ignorance. We have not gone beyond them. The tendencies are there. We have not transcended the level of tendencies. But there is no expression of those tendencies. In deep sleep or susupti, we are in a state of total lack of awareness. We are in a state of total ignorance. In waking state, we experience all these at a gross level. We make use of mind and also senses of perception, senses of action at a gross level. We walk with our feet and mind is also active at the gross level. In dream state, the same experience takes place, but it is happening at a subtle level. In waking state, in dream state also, we run in dream. But no, we don't use our feet, we are sleeping. We are listening to music, but we don't make use of the physical ears. Mentally we are hearing. So, because the senses of perception and senses of action are not involved in dream state, the experience is at the subtle level. In waking, deep sleep state, Shruti means deep sleep. There, all these experiences cease to exist, so far as we are concerned. The tendencies are there, but we are not aware of it. Mind loses its ability to be aware of the existence of tendencies within the system. It's a state of total unawareness. Yes.
So, Swami, tendency can die down?
Yes. Now, yeah, tendencies remain in a dormant condition.
Cannot die.
They will not die. They will, when we transcend them. When we transcend them, we reach the Turiya state. So, I will tell you, these are the four levels. Jagrat, Sopma, Susupti, Turiya. Mandukya Karya. Jagrat means waking state. Supna means dream. Susupti means deep sleep or dreamless sleep. In all these states, ignorance is there. We are not aware of our true nature. We become aware of our true nature when we transcend all these three states. And that state is called in Vedantic tradition, Turiya state. In which we transcend all this. Transcending is different from lying in a dormant condition. Because in deep sleep, these tendencies do not die out. That's why when we wake up after a long deep sleep, we remember all old tendencies, impressions, memories, they all return to the mind. But when we reach the Turiya state, which goes beyond all, it's the highest spiritual state of supreme awareness of our true nature. At that state, all these are transcendent. After reaching that state, it's called Jivan Mukta. After reaching the highest realization, when we come back to the waking state, we can live in this world, but we can look at the world and understand that this world and all the associated experiences are only relative, they are not permanent. We become unaware of the fact the world is not the absolute reality. The worldliness of the world is experienced. The illusoriness of the worldly experiences is strongly experienced when you return from the Turiya state back to the waking state. But deep sleep state, Susupti state is different. When we return from Susupti state, we bring back with us all the old accumulated tendencies, impressions and vasanas. They all remain there. But they are dormant in deep sleep. They become active after waking up. That's the idea.
In proper atmosphere and environmental condition.
Yes, 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 yes. So, we shall conclude. So we'll continue next day. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna.